You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his first week in office, President Obama signed an executive order to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay within the year. But that's proven to be easier said than done, and questions still remain about what to do with the remaining detainees. And while the Obama administration and Congress are working on creating a legal framework for dealing with terrorism suspects, federal judges in Washington have been shaping the law one case at a time as they've ruled on things brought by detainees seeking their freedom. Jonathan Mahler, author of the book The Challenge, about the groundbreaking Supreme Court case Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, and Chizun Lee, a lawyer and reporter for ProPublica, join us now to discuss the future of Guantanamo Bay and how the laws on detainees are being shaped. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having us.
Jonathan, Guantanamo detainees weren't granted the right to a federal trial until the 2006 Supreme Court case Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, which has been called this court's most important decision ever on presidential power and the rule of law. What did it rule?
Well, there were quite a few rulings involved, but the biggest ones really were two. And one was essentially that the president can't create this whole trial system in which he was planning to try the Guantanamo detainees or a number of the Guantanamo detainees, these military tribunals as they're known, that the president couldn't just sort of whole cloth write an entirely new set of rules of laws and create this trial system and appoint judges without input from Congress, that he needed to sort of first go to Congress. So it was in that sense it was a big check against presidential power. And and then the other sort of most significant aspect of the decision was that the United States had to honor the Geneva Conventions.
Can you remind us how it even reached the Supreme Court?
Sure, it was quite a journey. It began with a lawsuit filed by the Navy officer, the JAG lawyer, who was appointed to represent Salim Hamdan, who was Bin Laden's driver, who was captured in the aftermath of 9/11. So this Navy officer, Charlie Swift, Lieutenant Commander Swift, filed a lawsuit on behalf of this guy, sort of challenging the lawfulness of these military tribunals, and when he first filed the suit, it wasn't even clear that a judge, a federal judge, would be able to hear the case, because at that point in time, and this was in 2003, the Bush administration's position, and it was a position that was accepted generally by the federal courts, was that prisoners on Guantanamo Bay had no recourse, had no rights to the federal courts, that they were beyond the law. And indeed, that's the principal reason why the Bush administration chose to send detainees to Guantanamo Bay, to keep them outside the law. But lo and behold, the Supreme Court heard a case before Hamdan, in which the Rasool case, in which the court decided, yes, these guys actually do have some rights, and that the courthouse doors were open. And so from there, the case sort of made its way through the courts with a victory at the district court level, a big defeat at the appeals court level when in front of actually at the time Judge Roberts, who would now of course Chief Justice Roberts, and then they got a hearing at the Supreme Court in what as you mentioned earlier is one of the most important cases that the court has heard in presidential power.
And what has the impact been, Chizun?
Well, what's interesting is even after this landmark Hamdan ruling, the Bush administration continued to litigate to try and sort of block the power of federal courts to weigh in on the legitimacy of presidential detentions, all the way up until a ruling last June, in June of 2008, known as a Boumediene against Bush, where ultimately the Supreme Court finally said, look, prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay do have a constitutional right to go into a federal court and challenge the legality of their detentions and say, essentially, the president has the wrong guy here. I wasn't doing what they say I did. And I'm entitled under the doctrine of habeas corpus to have a ruling saying I'm not being held legitimately. So since that June 2008 ruling, the cases have actually started moving forward. Many of them were filed as early as May 2002. That case was just decided last week, almost, 7 years afterwards.
Are there many more cases awaiting trial?
Oh, sure. I think almost all of the detainees held there now, something like 230 men have filed habeas petitions, and they're just beginning to move through the process now. Some 33 have been decided to completion at the trial court level, where judges have looked at the classified evidence the government has presented and painstakingly gone through.
Now, are we talking about high-level detainees or low-level detainees, or has there been a mix?
Well, detainees running the gamut of suspected low-level, suspected high-level activity have filed these lawsuits, but for various reasons, the initial cases being decided are believed to be relatively low-level, and that's for different strategic reasons. I think some of the detainees' attorneys, from my reporting, you know, the ones with sort of the strongest cases to win release have been pushing their litigation faster and faster. And then the more complex cases, I think, you know, there is some negotiation and discussion going on between detainees, advocates, and administration lawyers.
And what kind of trials are we talking about? We're not talking about civil trials, are we?
These are cases being heard in the civil court by
the
federal
same,
judges.
The same kinds of rules that would apply to a case involving me.
That's right.
Innocent until proven guilty.
That's absolutely right.
Preponderance
of
evidence, et cetera.
That's what the lawyers are arguing for, yeah.
But what about the case of Hamdan? He was tried by a military commission, wasn't he, John?
He was tried by a military commission. And that's
July 21st, 2008,
that's
just
right.
About a year
that's
ago.
Right. That's right. After many years, I mean, the Bush administration first started sort of pursuing its case against him in 2002, 2003. And he was in fact to be the first Arab tried before these military tribunals, these historic military tribunals, and it took many years, in part because of all these legal challenges. So he finally came to trial last summer, and it was really quite dramatic because here he was really the poster boy for the war on terror. I mean, he was the guy who needed to be tried in these special courts where prisoners were deprived of many rights. As it turned out, this poster boy was his case was heard. A jury of military officers decided his fate, and they gave him 5 months. So you know the government was asking for a life sentence, and the jury felt that he was just basically a small fry and gave him 5 months.
Well, one of the reasons for using military commissions is because they were so effective during World War II. This is the first case since World War II.
But
they're not bound by the same rules as civilians.
That's right. I mean, the thing that's important to keep in mind with these military tribunals, and you know, I should point out that President Obama is continuing has at this point still planning to use them himself.
To the surprise of many people
yes.
who followed what he said during the election
that's
campaign.
Right. That's right. To the surprise and displeasure of many people. But something that's important to keep in mind about these military tribunals is yes, they were used effectively in World War II and have been used throughout American history. But they're always they've always been you know what are known as really kind of courts of necessity, battlefield courts. If you can't you know if the circumstances aren't right to have sort of a proper hearing and to sort of give someone sort of all of the guarantees of due process. Well, then you know in these unusual extenuating circumstances when you really need to move quickly, you can have these kind of battlefield courts. But here we're talking about a system that was you know it's been years now that these people have been you know have been away from the battlefield, and we're talking about a system that was created really essentially to bend the rules.
So he was sentenced to this very short sentence, and he'd served how many years already?
He'd basically been captured in the aftermath of 9/11. Had been in U.S. custody since November of 2001.
Has he been freed?
He's freed.
Where is he now?
He's back home in Yemen. He was, you know, even after his sentencing, the government was arguing that they could continue to hold him as an enemy combatant, even though he'd been sentenced. But they did ultimately let him go, and now he's back home.
Isn't one of the problems that military tribunals are based on the old rules of law, which don't necessarily apply to what's being called the war on terror?
There are quite a few problems. But you know, certainly one is that, became a big problem during the Bush years is you know this system was kind of modeled after the tribunals that were used in, as you said, in World War II, in the aftermath of World War II, which was really the last time that they'd been used.
And many people felt they were unconstitutional then.
Yeah, and we're talking about the advances that have occurred, and the sort of the changes in defendants' rights have obviously been dramatic since then. In military law in particular, I mean, a whole sort of system of military law in the United States has undergone a revolution since then. And of course, the Geneva Conventions have emerged since then. So we are talking about an outdated system, an outdated idea to begin with. But then, of course, yes, we have a very unusual kind of war, if you can even call it a war against terrorism. I mean, in fact, that's part of the debate: can we call it a war?
My guest is Jonathan Mahler, whose book *The Challenge* is now available in paperback from Picador. And Chisholm Lee, who is a lawyer and reporter for ProPublica, you wanted to add to that.
Yeah, well, I think that this last question, whether we're in a war and how it's different from any wars in the past, is the core question in a lot of ways about whether detentions by the military can keep going. And what's fascinating is looking at these cases that are going on at the civilian federal trial courts in D.C. right now. That's a body of work that shows you how judges are working through that very complicated question with the help of briefing from the government and from lawyers who are pushing back and saying, you can't just call this a global war and everything's a battlefield and anyone who shares these sort of beliefs can be held as a wartime captive. You need some sort of boundaries to that concept.
I mean, this is really the nut of the dilemma that Bush faced and that Obama's now facing, which is in a conventional war, you capture people on the battlefield. You hold them until the end of hostilities, and then you either release them or you make a deal to trade them with a country. But they're held until the end of hostilities. If this is indeed a war, the war on terror, how long is it going to go on? It could go on for generations. So that's the problem, and that's what's given rise to all this debate about indefinite detention and what are we going to do with these guys and how are we going to view them? And that is because this is a very different kind of war.
Well,
in quotes.
What are we hearing from the White House as an explanation for this, what seems to be a change in policy or attitude or continuation of a policy that President Obama criticized when he was candidate mm-hmm. Obama?
I think in some ways it's a continuation, and in other ways there has been an important sort of narrowing of the sweeping vision of this conflict.
They are trying
terrorists.
To get some of these guys out of Guantanamo.
They have been working, right. It seems, in good faith, from what I hear from detainees' advocates also, to transfer some individuals out. And also they have sort of tried to cabin the idea of where the authority to detain people in this conflict comes from. They've stepped away from the Bush administration's idea of this inherent commander-in-chief power that can't be touched and brought it down to a congressional act, the 2001 Authorization for Use of Military Force, which is more a traditional concept of Congress declares war and the president's military powers come out of that. And so that's a little bit of a sort of narrowing of the concept of presidential authority. At the same time, the detentions are continuing, and the administration's lawyers are defending them in court.
My guests are Chisholm Lee, a lawyer and reporter for ProPublica, and Jonathan Mahler, author of the book The Challenge, about the groundbreaking Supreme Court case Hamdan versus Rumsfeld. It's now available in paperback from Picador. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Chisholm Lee, who's both a lawyer and a reporter for ProPublica, and Jonathan Mahler, author of the book The Challenge, about the Hamdan versus Rumsfeld case, now available in paperback from Picador. You wanted to add something before we went to that break,
Jonathan? I was just going to say that we've seen, I think we are seeing the Obama administration really really kind of grappling with these issues, and we're in a sense we're seeing the process in kind of full view. I mean, just earlier this week, this proposal was floated that that perhaps what we would do is move the detainees on Guantanamo, because of course, you know, Obama has made this pledge to close Guantanamo by the end of his first term in office, so the clock is ticking. And this proposal was, well, perhaps we'll move them all to a maximum security facility in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, or in Standish, Michigan.
And people in Congress start screaming their heads off when that sort of thing is floated.
Right. Well, it's one of those. It's a situation where actually, as it turns out, both the right, the far right, and the right and the left, you could say, was unhappy because, of course, those on the right say that, we can't bring these people onto American soil. That will pose a threat to national security. And the people on the left are saying, well, you're basically just talking about recreating Guantanamo on the Great Plains. So I think, we're getting a chance to, we were just talking earlier about, whether or not we've seen a break with the Bush administration's policies in Obama, and I think the jury's still out. I think we're seeing Obama really wrestle with these very, very difficult questions.
Federal courts can overturn detention decisions if they decide they aren't valid. Are there fixed standards, Chi-Sun, or of what and what isn't valid?
There actually aren't there's no central set of rules by which
these cases. So they've been forced to come up with their own guidelines for validity?
Yes, and the Supreme Court was explicit about saying, let the lower federal courts work out these tough questions.
So one judge makes a ruling and then other judges work off of that?
That has actually been happening very much in practice. There have been a couple of key decisions on the core legal questions. For instance, what is the definition of someone who can be detained indefinitely by the military as opposed to having either to be released or charged with criminal charges and given a trial? And a couple of the judges have thought very deeply about this question and written extensively, and their colleagues have taken from those decisions. Others have just said, I'm going to go with the military's definition. It's not my job to create the legal standard, and I'm going to apply that military standard to the facts of this case.
Well, how many of the judges out there are experienced in national security law?
Well, it's interesting. We're talking here about the D.C. Federal Trial Court, which sees a good number of terrorism prosecutions, the old-fashioned kind, where U.S. prosecutors will file criminal charges against very dangerous suspects, and there'll be full-blown trials. And so in many ways, these issues aren't completely out of left field to people.
One of the issues that's come up again and again is whether classified information gathered by the CIA or the military can be kept secret during these trials, because it is the evidence against these accused.
Yes, in most cases, the classified information is the bulk of the evidence the government is offering against
these detainees. And
whether
witnesses can even testify against
that. That's right. And again, in most cases, witnesses, either no one knows where they are anymore, or their full names are not known, their whereabouts are not known. And what these judges have been doing, really in the absence of any law that tells them what to do, unlike in criminal trials where there is a federal statute that tells courts how to handle classified information, here they have been creating their own procedures, very much favoring the government's concerns about protecting sensitive information.
What about accusations of torture? How did they deal with that? Is there any way for them to even know whether these people have been tortured or whether they have admitted guilt because they were tortured?
Well, sure. Actually, the most recent example of that is the Jawad case, who a detainee who was captured his age is actually in dispute, but he was somewhere between, I think, 12 and 17, and he was just ordered released by the court, and it's precisely because it was deemed that all of the evidence against him was obtained via sort of coercive interrogation or torture. So that is going to be an issue. And just, on the state, the sort of state secrets, issue and the confidentiality issue, I mean, that has been a big issue from the beginning. And in fact, in the Hamdan case, it came up in the very beginning when he was, on Guantanamo, when his military tribunal began. And it was sort of voir dire. There was jury selection, and he was kicked out of the courtroom. And so, you know, I mean, it's because, of course, they were going to be, you know, hearing things potentially that were classified. And so these are, you know, obviously really delicate questions. I mean, you can't convict someone on evidence that they can't see. They need a defendant needs to be able to confront his accusers. But at the same time, there are certainly going to be national security concerns. And you know, Obama is, you know, sort of. Perhaps controversially, before the election, he sort of became an advocate of sort of protecting these state secrets. So, yeah.
In the case of the Jawad, in a normal case, a civil case, the age of the defendant would be a consideration.
Sure,
this
guy
was a juvenile. Was that something that was even came up in the court?
Well, that certainly seemed to move the federal judge who was hearing his habeas case quite a bit. But what's interesting, going back to something Jonathan said about the Jawad case, what's interesting is how it's actually quite an exception. I mean, the Obama administration agreed to stop defending his military detention very much, I think, because of these evidentiary issues, these allegations that, you know, a military judge himself has said he was coerced into confessing to this act. But there hasn't yet been a case among these 33 that federal judges have decided so far in the D.C. trial court where allegations of torture actually sunk the government's case against a particular detainee. You see the judges discussing this concern when they're talking about other evidence taken from other witnesses, sort of discrediting intelligence reports because proof is offered to the judge that, you know, the witness that they're citing actually gave this statement under some sort of coercive circumstances.
Or even in the Jawad case, that have been since just recently, there have been revelations that the witnesses were actually going to be paid, or at least sort of allegations that the government was going to sort of pay these sort of military guards from Afghanistan who you know allegedly saw him throw a grenade, or were at least sort of there at the time, that they were actually going to receive, I mean, you could probably call them bribes to testify. So.
My guests are Jonathan Mahler, whose book The Challenge is available now in paperback from Picador, and Chi-Sun Lee, a lawyer and reporter for ProPublica. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So what happens, Jonathan, after these cases are decided in federal court? Does a military commission in Guantanamo follow, or...
Well, the military commissions are only a sort of a select group of detainees have been designated for trial by military commission, and it's sort of thought that the guys who are going to be tried in the military commissions are the hardcore guys.
Otherwise, they're tried in federal civilian court.
Exactly, and even indeed, even in the case of Jawad, who has been ordered released, there's still a possibility. I believe it's still a possibility that he could be tried there could be a civil trial in federal court for him. So, that's the question. I mean, will we see a lot of a lot more trials in federal court now? Are a lot of these guys going to be tried in federal court, or will the Obama administration continue to sort of try to press ahead with these military tribunals? And my guess is that we'll probably see, you know, a combination of the two.
How many have been found guilty, and how many have been pretty much freed for lack of evidence or because of other problems?
Well, there are two different systems of justice going on. In the habeas cases, where the detainees are the ones filing the lawsuits saying, hey, I'm being held here illegally, there have been 33 of those cases decided so far. And 28 of the detainees who brought these cases have been found in federal court to be eligible for release. In other words, the administration's case saying that they're wartime prisoners, the judges have said the evidence isn't good enough to hold them. But I think 19 of them remain detained. And that really goes to the heart of the question that you were raising about, well, what next? What happens after a court rules? And that is that's sort of popularly known as the Uyghur question, right. Mm-hmm. The Chinese Muslim detainment.
Which is still unresolved. Some of them have finally
and
agreed.
I mean, I would just add to that category. You know, there's the two separate systems of justice, and then there's the third category, which is, in fact, the largest category, which is the people who aren't going to be brought to trial in either court system, who have been found, in many cases, to no longer pose a threat to the United States. There are 60, I believe, 60 detainees on Guantanamo who have been cleared for release, but the United States has nowhere to send them because they can't. They either come from a country with a sort of record of torture and human rights abuses, where it actually is a violation of the Convention Against Torture for the United States to return a prisoner to a country where he is likely to be tortured, or because a country doesn't want to take this person back, or a country doesn't want to take a person. So here we are, sort of stuck with these people who've been cleared for release.
And we've been trying to get other countries to take them. Yes. Ireland has agreed to accept 2 detainees for resettlement. That's not really going to solve this problem.
And I know I noticed a little story in the paper today that five of the Uyghurs are I guess in Bermuda and we're working on a golf course and we're on the grounds crew at a golf course in Bermuda. But I mean there are a lot more that need to be resettled. As I said, I think there are 60 who've already been cleared for release and there's nowhere to send them.
Is there a concern that some people who may have been picked up for the wrong reason have been so politicized by the experience at Guantanamo? I'd imagine that if I felt I'd been held unjustly for many years, I might want to wreak some vengeance.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's right.
There was that article in the Times that suggested that quite a few had joined various groups, jihadist groups. Then the number turned out to be a lot, quite inflated.
That's right. I mean, it's obviously an anti-American hothouse, and I mean one of the things I sort of write about a bit, and the challenge is in the book is how Hamdan himself was part of the task of his lawyers was to kind of prevent him from becoming so radicalized that he would no longer speak with them and no longer kind of agree to cooperate with his legal case. So there's no question that and in fact that sort of underscores perhaps more than anything the importance of closing Guantanamo because in a sense this prison facility that was designed to keep America safe may, in fact, be posing the greatest risk to national security of all.
President Obama himself has said several times that the existence of Guantanamo is a danger to us and that it serves as a recruiting tool for enemies.
Exactly.
But I think it is important, folks will say that it's important to be skeptical of some of the Defense Department figures that are put out about how many people
returned
were radicalized and they returned to actual physical violent activity. You know, it's one thing to say people have resented their time there, which seems normal and human, and another to extrapolate from that to say an army of terrorists is being created there. And a judge who ruled on one of those cases last week, a habeas case last week, quoted in her written opinion that I wrote about this fascinating passage from an interrogation report of this detainee, Khalid al-Mutari. I'm probably butchering the pronunciation of his name, but she took the time to quote from his interrogation report, and he said something to the effect of, you know, I wasn't a hater of America before I was captured and brought here, but America has made an enemy of me. I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, partly because I think the legal process is a joke. When am I getting out of here? And the judge quoted it in that context.
Hasn't President Obama said that some of these detainees cannot be tried? What does that mean?
Well, I think he's talking about evidentiary problems. And as you look through these federal court decisions, it's interesting to see the judges wrestling with this too and saying how interrogation reports will often be sort of summaries from a field officer about what they learned from various witnesses at some site. And you get the sense a lot of the information is classified, but the judges tell us as much as they can about the evidence. And you get the sense that sometimes there are no names. Sometimes there are no times or places. And I would imagine they call us witnesses.
Yeah. So I mean.
Well, yeah, and the judges have been letting the government off the hook on that, making a very big exception for this typical legal rule where witnesses have to be able to come into court and answer for themselves.
So it sounds to me that whether the president would like to close Guantanamo by the end of the year or not, it's unlikely that that's going to happen, just simply because of all these logistical problems.
That seems to be the case from people I talk to. And, you know, in some ways, some people on both sides of the issue will say it's best to get it done right instead of just, you know, kind of come up with some list of procedures that.
But what does right mean? With the Uyghurs, for example, there doesn't seem to be a right. They were unjustly held. Everybody agrees they were unjustly held, and now nobody knows where to send them.
Right. Well, I mean, I think maybe right in this instance means working through these difficult questions that we've been talking about, so that you're not just simply, transporting en masse, 240 prisoners to another facility, and leaving all of these questions of the admissibility of evidence, of who's going to be tried and who's not going to be tried, of detention and when, is indefinite detention, is the president going to be able to indefinitely detain people? We need to work through all of these questions, not simply move Guantanamo to some other prison.
Jonathan Mahler is the author of The Challenge: How a Maverick Navy Officer and a Young Law Professor Risked Their Careers to Defend the Constitution and Won. It's published by Picador. And Chi-Sun Lee is a lawyer and reporter for ProPublica. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
It's a pleasure.